Let me get this all done. Okay. I'm in studio right now with Anne Marie Hancock, and she is the author of You Can't Drive Yourself to Your Own Funeral. And I love the title. I love the book. I guess let's get to the first question. So why did you write the book?
I hadn't intended, Phil, to write a book. It's a funny thing. I kept a journal for 3 years while taking care of my mom. And then after she passed, I went back and read it. And there were so many lessons for me to learn. And it was like every day, something new, something new. And it's difficult sometimes dealing with complex people. And I thought, I've really picked up some stuff during this journey, and I really think it needs to be shared. I've always been a very private person, and people who've read my other books have said, you know, they're nice, but you don't put yourself out there. Well, this time I did. And, of course, it leaves you wide open and vulnerable, but we all are. And that's why I felt it was extremely important to share the lessons I learned, because there are so many across this country going through the exact same thing.
And I also, at the beginning of the book, you said that in 2012, your life was beautiful and uncomplicated, and then something happened. What happened?
Well, there are many things that have happened. I don't know what specifically we're talking about. My daughter was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. My heart stopped. We were celebrating my 50th birthday in the mountains in Wintergreen. And family went out to bring luggage in. They planned a big party. Came in and found me on the floor. And I woke up 3 days later at Augusta Medical. Thank you, beautiful people up there who brought me back. And it's kind of a funny story because the doctors were all around the bed. I don't have a lot of recall. I know we drove through in an ice storm across the mountain that night in the ambulance, and they resuscitated me on the way to the hospital. This I've been told. But when I woke up, there were four doctors at the foot of the bed and looking at me, they said, "Mrs. Hancock, do you know who the President of the United States is?" I said, "Of course, Hillary Clinton." And they looked just aghast, like, "Oh my gosh, we've lost her again." My husband just laughed. He said, "Oh, she's back."
I love the fact that through this book, throughout the book, you do add a lot of humor into the book to offset some of the challenges that you had to deal with, you know, especially with your mother. And I think that was the question I was going for, that it was 2012 when your mother was diagnosed with cancer.
Right, right. I stepped away from everything I was doing for 3 years and made up my mind I was going to care for her. And my mother was a nurse and really didn't think she needed any care. And I'd go over every morning at around 8 o'clock. I'd call at 8 o'clock. She didn't answer. I'd put a trench coat on over my pajamas and go, and took her to the CAT scans, the MRIs, doctor's appointments, just about everything you can think of. You get no prize for that. This is what we do for the people that we love. But my mom was a very complex woman, and I'll give you an example that I've shared previously. I think I shared it in the book. Picked her up one day and thought we were going to the GP, and we were going in another direction to another doctor. So we're driving down Charter Colony here in Richmond, and I hear, "Anne, you're a moron." I said, "What?" She said, "Anne, you're a moron." I pulled over to the side of the road and said, "Of course, Mom, is there a problem?" She said, "Yes, you're a moron." I said, "I have news for you. I was in Ireland a few years ago researching at your request the family name, which is spelled M-O-R-E-N. And I was quickly told that we are a family of morons. It's pronounced moron. So that being the case, we're in this together. We're both morons. Now, where are we going?
I love that. I love that in the book, too. I love that, that part. Yeah, that was so funny. It was so funny. Did your mom get it then? I mean, did she?
Well, she used to say, Ann, you're not funny. And I'd see her grin, you know. It's like she told me I drove like Moses. And I'd say, Mom, when did you meet Moses? And you're not funny. And then she'd grin. Mm-hmm. So I think often humor is our saving grace, and it would break the ice because people who are suffering have so much fear and anxiety, and particularly the terminal. They know that this is a journey they're making alone. And we can all give advice and books and lectures, which nobody wants, nobody. But they're making it alone. And that being the case, they have so many thoughts and fears and so much anxiety. We need to love them right where they are and appreciate that. Let them talk when they feel like talking, and let them express. I always thought it was kind of a backhanded compliment when she would say, you're a moron, or, and you're not funny, because she was so comfortable with me that she could truly say whatever she was feeling. So that was a backhanded blessing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what was the bond like between you and your mother before her diagnosis of cancer, and what was it like after?
My mom always loved her. We were a pretty close family, to say the least. But I felt that this disease brought me much closer to her. Previous to the disease, Mom always came up very strong, very courageous, very confident, and when she spoke, it was gospel, and you didn't question it. What I saw during this journey with cancer was fear. I saw at times a small child who was frightened. I saw her one night after a 14-hour surgery in a local hospital. Her whole head bandaged. She had squamous cell cancer. Just her eyes, nose, and mouth exposed. And she wasn't saying anything for hours. I stayed the night with her. And then out of the blue, I just held her hand. She said, Ann, you're very nice to me. You're very gentle with me. I still carry that in my heart. Because she didn't talk like that. Mm. The journey changed her. The journey changed me. And then after moments like I shared about the moron, it would be later in the day and I'd be dropping her off on Crim Point. And she'd turn around. I don't know if I said it or not. I said, what's that, Mom? I love you.
Oh.
And Mom was not one to say it. She would show it in other ways, but she was not verbal that way. Mm-hmm. So it was like, wow, that was nice.
You know, I think that was also generational within her family, too.
Yes.
That was not something that was used a lot, at least maybe. I'm just...
No, I think you're right. And I knew my grandmother and was blessed to have time with her before she passed. And a lot of the folks in that generation called their husbands. For instance, my husband's grandmother, they called each other Mr. and Mrs. Hancock at the dining room table, at the breakfast table. It's quite stunning. But things were more proper, more formal, more private, as I said before. Mm-hmm. You didn't air your dirty laundry, and you were tough, and you suffered silently. You didn't discuss family problems. You and I were talking, Phil, before airtime. Now, Facebook, people write about their broken marriages and they share their problems with their family and put it all out there. But that was a time, a generation, as with my grandmother, my mother's mother, they didn't do those things. And my grandmother was, she was very tough, very tough. And you rarely, same thing, I saw her verbally or physically express affection, but she'd make you peanut brittle.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew intuitively that was her way.
Right, right. I had a grandmother like that too. She was from Naples. She ended up being the same way. I just want you to read this short passage that's in here when you talk about the mother and daughter bond, because I want to add that in.
Okay. Mothers and daughters have a special bond. We're connected by more than the umbilical cord and for a lifetime. Many spend their lives trying to prove themselves to their parents. We become overachievers. We dance to their song. We live according to their rules because we're all looking for love. We're all, every one of us, looking for acceptance.
I felt that too. I definitely did. And this kind of goes right into this next question. You shared that your mother was angry when you brought her food every day. And how did you react initially when she got angry? And did you realize that your mother's way of processing change or?
Well, you know, I think we had said a few moments ago, Mom was always very sure of herself. She spoke very directly. And that being the case, I wasn't expecting tremendous warmth. I knew she was frightened. And my father had died during this process suddenly. And he was an athlete. He was still playing tennis at 88 twice a week. And that was a stunner. So I'm thinking all of this is going on in Mom's head. And consequently, another lesson I think I had to learn, when you walk in the door with chicken salad for the second time in a week, and he goes, oh no, not more chicken salad.
Mm.
It's not about the chicken salad. It's about a rough day. It's about feeling terrible. It's about looking to the future and the journey. And there were a couple times that she said to me, so Anne, what do you think heaven's about? What do you think it's like? You believe, I know. And we talk a little bit. But she would revert back and forth, I know, at the end of her journey, because she didn't talk a lot about spiritual things or her cancer. I called Father Glass, down in Williamsburg, family friend, and I asked him to call her. I said, just chat with her and give her an opening to say whatever she'd like to say or ask the question she'd like to ask. Well, he called her, called me back in less than a minute. He said told me she's great. And also told me, you know, I'm 90 years old now, or 91. How could I commit a sin at my age? He said that was our conversation.
Well, it sounds like he was a very good priest, too, and a very
beautiful.
Good listener. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you said something extremely important, Phil. We think we have to say this or say that, and I did too at the beginning of the journey. Okay, I've got to go in today and say something helpful, hopeful, uplifting, and inspiring. No, you don't. You just need to be there.
Mm.
You just need to be present and to take your cues from the sick, from the suffering, from the one you're caring for. Sometimes they want to talk. And you can engage. And you They're very clear about where they want to go in conversation and where they don't. Other times you may be sitting there and there is nothing coming out. And that's an opportunity for us as caretakers to go do some dishes, maybe do a little laundry quietly, check the meds and make sure everything is in order, check the refrigerator, make sure there aren't things going bad, or that there are things you know on a good day this person would love to eat. So we can use our time wisely, but we don't always have to do it with words.
I agree. And because we spoke about it, been there.
Well, now you have. You told me.
Yeah, so it was the same way.
It's a learning experience, and we will all, every one of us, go through it.
Right.
Every one of us. And
I would ask Ted, on occasion, I would say, Ted, what do you see? What do you think? Because there were times that he would just look around the room, and I know he saw something.
Right.
But he wasn't telling me. Like, was it something that I should not know, or what? Are you seeing the other side? Is there something going on? I wanted to know, and, you know, the anger level was there.
Yeah.
And I think in his case, he did not want to go. It wasn't so much he was afraid of what was happening on the other side. It was the fact that he did not want to go.
Did he open up more towards the end? Because I believe with all my heart, they know. They know.
No. And the only thing that saved me was the fact that after he passed, and of course you have to put that brave front on, and I figured I needed to be stoic at that point. You know, I didn't want to just break down. And you know, but I had a dream, and I dreamt about him, and in my dream, I was holding him in my arms. I actually had his whole body in my arms.
Wow.
And he was light. I mean, actual light.
Oh.
You know, and all of a sudden, he turned his face to me, and it was his face, and then he kissed me, and the dream was over.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So he did come to visit, but...
What an incredible validation that he is at peace. And also for everybody listening, that there's more, that this is just God's other door.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, the unknown is what's so scary, because you don't know what's on the other side of the door.
We can talk about it. We can read everything written by man. But the bottom line is, and we said it, you're making the journey alone.
Right.
And no one has ever come back physically to talk about it and say, hey, it's great, you know. Of course, now with people like Raymond Moody, there are so many books where people have been resuscitated and can describe everything heard and said in the room. I know when my heart stopped when I was 50, I heard something my middle daughter said at the side of the bed. Obviously, I couldn't speak or anything, but a few days later, when everyone was in the room, I remember looking at her and saying, I heard what you said, and repeated it. And she was stunned. She said, you couldn't have, Mom. You were gone.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're never really gone.
No.
Just God's other door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you hear the love. And the one thing, of course, the title of the book, You Can't Drive Yourself to Your Own Funeral.
Right.
And this has so much to do with your mother. Can you explain?
Yes, I would love to explain. My mom's car was her ticket to freedom. It's so symbolic in the writing, in the book, because the car in psychology represents the vehicle taking us to or toward or away from something. And even the color, Mom's little Toyota was red. Mm-hmm. It's a very feisty, high energy color.
Mm-hmm.
But the license plate is very notable. And it read PRRFCT. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. When Mom was in that car, she was happy, she was free. I can remember one of the days that she ended up in the hospital. We had explained it wasn't safe for her to drive with all the drugs and so forth. And everybody went on to church services on a Sunday morning. She went out to the garage and tried to get in that car. And I got a call from my daughter because we were at Mass. And she was in the hospital. She had fallen. My daughter had gone to her, Faith. She had dragged herself through the garage, back up into her home to a telephone, and called my daughter. And Faith had said, you can't imagine. It was like a bloodbath, the garage, the rug, the living room. But the point being, the determination to get in that car and to drive. And of course, we immediately, as soon as Faith called, went to the hospital, and they had several stitches in her head again. And first thing she said was, I'm ready to go home. I need to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So she was always looking forward, always moving on, and never wanted to discuss tragedy or trauma. And also very cautious in terms of discussing spiritual things. We'd have a few conversations that were just so memorable for me. And it would be sort of offhand. We'd be eating that chicken salad. And she'd say, so what do you think about heaven? And it was like, wow.
Because you weren't expecting it.
No. And then I'd engage. But after about 5 minutes, because I love to talk about God, I just love to talk about God. After about 5 minutes, she'd look at me and she'd say, that's enough, Ann. I don't need a lecture. And I said, I'm sorry. I just get so excited talking about God.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to give her everything in terms of the peace and the love that he has for her and for all of us. But she took in as much as she wanted to. And then she had control, like the car. You know, she was in control.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I have enough information. Now, do we have any lemonade?
I mean, you know, as you get older, I know that, was that one of the things that when she said she had to get her driver's license again, I thought that was really funny. When she had called you on the phone and said, I got it.
Yes, early in the morning.
And you said, you got what?
We talked to her, and now you know with cancer you're on so many drugs, and her age was advanced, but that was not the issue because she was so energetic and feisty. But the cancer had gone to her brain. It had cracked her spine. She had cellulitis. She'd had a heart attack. So you can see the concerns there. So we did have the 4 o'clock in the afternoon discussion, Mom. It's your turn. Let us do things for you. You've got a whole family here in the city, and that's a blessing. And I'm here, and I'll, you know, anything you need, we can take care of it as a team. I don't need a team. I want to drive my own car.
And you said also, it was said that nobody said anything to her about it. It was like one of those things that you all kept to yourselves and you never brought up to her because of what you thought was going to come from her. Or what was the reason why you didn't talk about it with her?
Yeah, the car?
Yes.
Well, we would talk around it because, one, you wanted to communicate. You wanted to make sure she got the message. And if you were too aggressive or assertive, she would cut you off. Like, I'll give you an example. Mom, let's talk about the car for a minute. I'm not doing that. I'm not talking about the car. So your approach would be to sidestep and say, well, you know, you've got a lot on your plate right now. We want to help. So we were all chatting, and there are some things we can do. And one of them is, You know, we love your company. We can take you to these appointments and bring you home, and you don't have to worry about it. So we would talk around, but to it, so that she would hear us. And we would talk about, I know the meds sometimes are a problem. And, you know, I had to take Oxycontin once with squamous cell, and it makes you feel a little funny. So I was so happy to have someone to help me and pick up the slack and do a few things for me.
But that was not your mom.
She would say, I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing, and you're very subtle. But I'm driving my car.
And the other one, before I get into the last question for you, was when you were out to lunch with her best friend or good friend, and she decided that she did not want to go, but there's a story here.
Oh, my gosh, is there a story? I have beautiful friends, Phil. I know you do, too. We all do. But there are some that really hang tight when you need them, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. And this Coco Marcello here in Richmond is one of them. So she suggested taking her to lunch. And we did that often. But so we called and said, let's do this. You love French onion soup. We'll go here tomorrow and just have a nice visit. Okay, that was it. And the next morning rolled around, and I called, and I said, we're coming to pick you up. No, not today. I don't feel like it. So I called Coco, and she said, well, let's us go to lunch. So we went to lunch. We're finished. We're coming out. And Coco looks across the parking lot. True story. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. She goes, isn't that your mom's little red Toyota? It looks like perfect there on the license plate. And I'm looking. I said, yes, it is. Oh, my gosh. I said, what do you think we should do? And maybe we should follow her for a bit just to make sure she's okay. Never spoke to her about it. But I guess she blew us off for a taco that day. She was coming out of Taco Bell.
She is a hoot.
She is. She's hilarious.
I mean, I just fell in love with your mom. I knew she's hilarious. She was tough, and the situation was really tough between you two, because you were there to love her and care for her and just protect her. And I guess that's my last question, too, that what caretakers should know when they're caring for somebody that they love. And or maybe someone that's close to them, you know, maybe they're giving of their time to become a caretaker and care for these folks. What do they need to know?
I think the most important thing, and at the top of the list, is to believe in yourself. I've talked to hundreds of people this year who tell me they feel very beaten up and they feel discouraged. They feel like they're not enough. And they go home like that every day, and it's not a good situation. So I say, please believe in yourself. You're made in the image and likeness of God. You're a miracle. Every one of us are miracles. You are doing the very best you can. Believe in yourself and believe in your God. There is only one God. He didn't divide us. We divided ourselves. So that your God... Pray to your God and get on your knees every night. Thank him for the opportunity to serve, to help, and ask him. I mean, I would do it daily. Ask him for the words to say that are appropriate. Ask him to help you to know when to speak, when not to, what to do, what not to. Because he's there, not just for me, but for everybody. And so many nights, I mean, I could actually just feel a strength when I would say the prayer, Lord, you know, her heart, my mind, my body, my soul, hers. Help me tomorrow. Make this a great day. Make it a good day. And if it isn't what I want it to be, let thy will be done.
I thank you so much.
Thank you.